Just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. I'll lock my heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day. Moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes and I'll see you with my heart.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
It's Good News Week. Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky.
For thought-provoking dialogue and talks that penetrate Orange County and beyond, listen to Subversity on KUCI 88.9 FM and webcast at KUCI.org. That's Subversity with your host, Dan Tseng, each Monday at 9 a.m. on KUCI.
Get the lowdown on the publishing industry. Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett. She talks to anyone who's anyone in publishing. Thursdays, 5 p.m.
on KCI FM in Irvine.
The opinions and views expressed on this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show or other programs on KUCI, please log on to KUCI.org for the latest program schedule.
And hello again, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today I am just so delighted to have Amy Hempel with us. She is the author of The Dog of Marriage, Tumble Home, At the Gates of the Animal Kingdom, and Reasons to Live, and the co-editor of Unleashed. Her stories have appeared in Elle, GQ, Harper's, Playboy, The Quarterly, The Yale Review, and Vanity Fair. She's a Guggenheim Fellowship recipient and teaches at the Graduate Writing Program at Bennington. She lives in New York City, and we're here to talk about her work, her recent collection, The Collected Stories, Amy Hempel, and just whatever else we can get into this hour. It won't be enough time, but it's something. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you on.
Thank you.
I have followed your work since probably the early 80s, and so it's a real delight to have you here with us.
Thank you so much.
Oh, sure. I wanted to read from Rick Moody's introduction, mm-hmm. just a little bit, and he says at the end of it, what a wonderful introduction, by the way.
I'll say, very generous of Rick.
Well, just wonderful, and this is from the end. From such a life comes work that is consonant with what is greatest, what is most inspiring and transportative about the history of literature over the course of the last few centuries. Hempel, I'd argue, knows as much as anyone since Kafka about the tendency of human beings to do much better at dreaming than living. How to explain where these stories come from, short of prying open the writer? If it were Hempel herself trying to answer the question, she would avoid reply and would come up instead with some howlingly funny line to deflect away the sad fact that some questions are simply unanswerable. The best we can do is to try to keep on living and to take pleasure where it is available, especially, for example, in the pleasure of language. You are about to participate in that particular pleasure richly. It's all about the sentences. Wow.
Well, he's right about the sentences. I mean, I write at the sentence level. I read at the sentence level. It is the basic unit of construction for a prose writer, just as the line is the unit of construction for a poet. And I love sentences that sound like nothing I've ever heard before. And that's always what I'm trying to do myself.
Where does that come from? I mean, obviously you have a rhythm or a beat or something that you hear when you're writing.
Yeah. I think in my case it comes in part from loving music, music being so important to me always, and from loving poetry and wishing I could write poetry. But what I do is as close as I can get. It comes from sounds, just liking sounds. Sound. I mean, just ambient sound, even. Remember the old dumb question people would ask, well, if you had to give up your eyesight or your hearing, you know, which would you go without? And I hope I don't have to make the choice of it, but I would give up sight, I think, because sound is so important.
Mm-hmm. So do you read your work aloud?
Always when I'm writing. I mean, sentence by sentence. And I think most writers know that they will hear something they won't see reading it silently off the page. You can hear the black hole where it just falls into nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always important to do that, I think.
Now, you've been dedicated to the short story form. Well, I discovered your work in the early 80s, so I don't know how long it's been going on for you, but
25 years.
25 years. So what drew you to the short story and what keeps you there?
I think I just have a sort of built-in feel for the moment. I don't experience a day, for example, or you know, much less a year, in terms of a kind of big epic sweep of time and cause and effect. I can recognize a moment when something shifts. And everything is different after that, and I'm interested in those moments as they accrue and affect bigger and bigger changes in a life. I can do that. It's what I can do. I have never written a novel. I have never tried to write a novel. I wrote one novella, and maybe I'm starting one now. I'm not sure, but there's something just so satisfying to me about writing and reading a story.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Amy Hempel. Her new book is The Collected Stories. And And what a wonderful book this is.
Thank you.
So many stories from other collections, and mm-hmm. what a pleasure. You write about dogs a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well,
I've always wondered, because I remember from your early collections, mm-hmm. I loved them for a lot of reasons, but I loved that there were so many dogs, and not your usual dog story, but they
were.
No.
No, I mean, it's so easy to lapse into sentimentality, and I know I do from time to time, or just embrace it head on, but as a girl, I just love dogs, most animals, but especially dogs, and I realized not long ago that if you do a word association, somebody said face. You know, what do you see when I say the word face? And I saw a dog face, not a human face, and that's how aligned I feel with them. And I've worked with them. I mean, I've had dogs as pets forever, but I have also worked with dogs at a guide dog training school north of the city, north of Manhattan, for about 7-8 years. And I admire them. I love them. They're funny. You know, they're hilarious. They're true. And, you know, all the things that people who love dogs know about dogs, and just made them very important to me.
Mm. On your website, you say, getting back to the short story form, mm-hmm. you say, I always know the first line and the last line when I start.
Right.
Along with knowing the beat, the rhythm of the first line or the first paragraph.
Right. It's nothing I set out to do. It just sort of happened in the beginning with the very first story I wrote, and it continues to be the case that I don't really get started until I know where it ends. That doesn't mean I know how to get there. I don't. But strangely, it's never changed. I've never started a story and ended up changing the last line that I had when I started.
Hmm.
It seems so I need a destination. It's hard. It's so hard to get there that I have to know I'm going somewhere I want to go.
Yeah. So you have the first, you have the last, and then mm-hmm. Just making yourself sit in the chair every day and seeing what comes out, or do you futz around and make notes and say, well, maybe this story's about this or that, or how does it evolve?
It's a very fragmented enterprise, and I certainly don't do it every day, but I used to have a basket, literally a straw basket filled with scraps with little phrases or words I wanted to use, and I don't do that anymore, but I'll start with something I overheard, or it never starts with story, with something happened, or something very small. As I said, it's just a little moment when something shifts. Maybe, for example, I think most people have had the experience of just loving something about a person when they meet the person, and there comes a point when the very thing that drew them to that person repels them.
Mm,
and
yes.
That's interesting to me, when, why, how that happens. That's the kind of little turn I'm drawn to. But it will be something emblematic that will bear on something larger if I've done a good job.
Mm-hmm. And then at what point does the title come about?
Titles, usually at the beginning, but sometimes the end. It's funny, I teach a lot, I teach writing a lot, and students seem to have trouble with titles. It's maybe the only thing that's come easily to me about writing. And it's I think people often tend to give too much away in a title. I mean, you want to signal a reader, you know, here's a particular stance, here's something to reckon with, but not spell it out.
Mm-hmm. In this collection, I guess it was in the Reasons to Live collection, the mm-hmm. story that has the title that might be the most cryptic to, especially to non-knitters.
the unpronounceable title.
The unpronounceable title. Yes. I wouldn't know how to pronounce it even. I know how to read it and do it, but that's about
right.
it.
I don't think it is pronounceable, and I refer to it as The Knitting Story, which I could have titled it that too, I suppose. But knitters know what I'm getting at.
Where did this story come from?
That story?
Yeah.
Well, again, a decision, a moment when, in this story, two women, very good friends, find out the same time they're pregnant. One goes on to have the baby, and one ends the pregnancy. And it's okay, then there's the awkwardness, the how do you navigate that decision, that moment when one made the decision not to and one goes ahead. And it's tricky. I thought, well, that would be a tricky thing to look at. And that's just all I started with.
Interesting. And then the story before that in the cemetery where Elle Jolson is buried.
Yeah. Well, that's the first story I wrote. And I had followed the ape language experiments for many years and found them fascinating, as you know, most people do, and heartbreaking. You know, the chimps, for example, who are taught to sign and can communicate with humans, and then the money runs out for the experiment, or the funding runs out on the research project, and it's just unimaginable to me, just the kinds of cruelty that they endure. And I found that as a way into a story about the true part of that story is that my best friend, when I was in college and for a short time after, in Los Angeles, was diagnosed with leukemia and was 9 months from the date of diagnosis till the day she died. And I felt I had failed her when I absolutely could not fail her, and that is when she was dying. And I think everybody has a horrible secret. This was an assignment in a workshop at Columbia taught by Gordon Lish. Write your worst secret, the thing you'll never live down, the thing mm-hmm. that dismantles your own sense of yourself. And everyone in that class knew without any prompting what that worst secret was. And that's what that's why I wrote that story. And you know, it's now in I think 20 plus languages, which is funny to me because it's the first thing I wrote.
Mm.
But apparently it got to something in people.
Well, it's interesting, you know, what you're saying about where it came from, because it's a raw story, but I would never think that it came from such a personal place. So that you, it's like you're there, but you're not there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's an accurate assessment.
Mm. Will you read to us?
Sure. I can read a short short. I'm very partial to short short stories.
And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. And Amy Hempel is here with us for the hour, and she's about to read to us.
Thank you. This is a story in just two pages titled Weekend. The game was called on account of dogs, Hunter in the infield, Tucker in the infield, Bosco and Boone at first base. First grader Donald sat down on second base, and Kirsten grabbed her brother's arm and wouldn't let him leave third to make his first run. Unfair, her brother screamed, and the dogs, roving umpires, ran to third. Good power, their uncle yelled, when Joy, in a leg cast, swung the bat and missed. Now put some wood to it. And when she did, Joy's designated runner, cousin Zeke, ran to first, the ice cubes in his gin and tonic clacking like dog tags in the glass. And when Kelly broke free from Kirsten and this time came in to make the run, members of the Kelly team made Tucker in the infield dance on his hind legs. It's not who wins, their coach began and was shouted down by one of the boys. There's first and there's forget it. Then Hunter retrieved a foul ball and carried it off in the direction of the river. The other dogs followed, barking, mutinous. One second here. Dinner was a simple picnic on the porch, paper plates in laps, the only conversation a debate as to which was the better grip for throwing shoes. After dinner, the horseshoes were handed out, the posts pounded in, the rules reviewed, with the new rule added due to falling down shorts. The new rule, have a tire. The women smoked on the porch, the smoke repelling mosquitoes, and the men and children played on even after dusk when it got so dark that a candle was rigged to balance on top of the post and was knocked off and blown out by every single almost ringer. Then the children went to bed, or at least went upstairs, and the men joined the women for a cigarette on the porch, absently picking ticks engorged like grapes off the sleeping dogs. And when the men kissed the women goodnight and their weekend whiskers scratched the women's cheeks, the women did not think shave. They thought stay.
Hmm. Thank you so much. I read that story yesterday. I was sitting in the car waiting for my son to get out of school.
Oh, uh-huh.
I was so struck by the ending of that. Mm. You know, a perfect ending. And
Thank
so I was
you.
Trying to deconstruct the story and see why it worked so well. And of course, I couldn't do that, but I just
That's
knew
okay.
that it did.
Maybe too much analysis is not a good thing. But I mean, I can tell you that in the spirit of the moment when something changes, what I wanted to do in this very short story was just to show a moment when it's so simple, when you expect something to hurt and it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
You expect, the man at the end of the weekend, the husband's going to kiss his wife on the cheek, and he's going to have those whiskers that are going to stick out just long enough to really hurt, and it doesn't. And instead of thinking the man should shave, they think stay. And stay, of course, goes back to the dogs that the story started with, the dogs who won't stay, who won't obey, and just run off with the ball and wreck the game.
Oh, so writing short, you before you read this story, you said that you especially like short stories.
Yes, and the shortest story I know about is attributed to Gertrude Stein, and it's a story called Longer, and it's four words long. She stayed away longer. And I kind of think that's the time to beat. That's the time I want to beat. I haven't gotten down to that length yet. I have a story in The Dog of the Marriage that is a very short one sentence.
Which one is that?
It's a story called Memoir, and I mean, I can tell you the whole story is as follows. Just once in my life, when have I ever wanted anything just once in my life?
Yes.
And I hope if I do another collection someday to have one shorter than that.
So what makes a story then? What is a story?
Mm. There are a couple of definitions I like, and one comes from Ken Kesey, and it's just very basic, but pretty much covers it. He says it's what someone wants and what he's going through to get it. My former teacher and editor, Gordon Lish, had used to define a story by saying that it's not what happens to people on a page, it's what happens to a reader in his heart and mind. Well, but how do you make that happen? And we would talk about how what's interesting is not a situation so much as who's in it and mm-hmm. what they're making of it. And that's your chance to make it new, to say something new. And it's where wonderful voices come in, you know, the so-called voice-driven fiction, the people who don't sound like anybody else. And, you know, you could read one line of a story by certain writers and without seeing a byline, you would know who wrote it.
Yes,
so, but more about what a story is, another way to think of it is just maybe when two people or two ideas are passionate about something and completely opposed to each other, and they're both right.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to yield something interesting and a story.
Hmm.
But and I just like to think of it as simply something changes. Something changes.
Something changes. Yeah. Well, when we come back, we're going to talk about this more because I wanted to ask you about Epiphany, and now we're at the break. So
okay.
So all of you out there, don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with more Amy Hempel. Stay tuned.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
None of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays, 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI FM in Irvine. Bye-bye.
Yee-haw!
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the management of KUCI or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show, go to kuci.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org, and we are podcasting. If you go to either my website, penonfire.com, and click on the radio tower, or go directly to writersonwriting.blogspot.com, you will reach the podcast page with all of the shows that we have up so far. There's, I don't know, 36, 44, more all the time. This show will put up next week. And, you know, I know we're on a lot of iPods walking around the planet. So that's a wonderful thing. Today, my guest is Amy Hempel. She's been with us since 5 o'clock, and her most recent book is The Collected Stories. And here she is again. Hello there.
Hi there. It's Barbara. Thanks.
Before the break, you were talking about the short story form, and you said that basically something simply changes at the end of a short story. There's been some change.
Mm-hmm.
In the novel, of course, the change tends to be more sweeping and
right.
epic and
mm-hmm.
and more of an epiphany, I would guess.
I think so.
But you hear of that word, that dreaded word among some short story writers, epiphany, in regards to short stories. What do you think about all that?
Well, I don't tend to think about it when I'm writing, or even much after. I mean, there's a funny way in which I think I said earlier something about, well, maybe too much analysis isn't always
mm-hmm.
a good idea. And I really am afraid sometimes, although I teach writing and, you know, I review books and I write fiction. I am, I guess, respectful of mystery. And I remember a writer I admire enormously, Tim O'Brien,
yeah.
used to say, stories are not explanations. And he was speaking to the tendency of a lot of student writers, largely, to just explain, wrap everything up and explain it away. And no, mystery is something you want to promote, not obliterate in fiction.
So how do you teach? How do you teach short story writing? What do you have your students do?
Well, most recently I tried something that yielded very interesting results. I'm big on coming at it sideways, sort of tricking yourself into writing because
mm-hmm.
it seems so daunting to many people and certainly to me still. So there are wonderful list stories such as Leonard Michael's story In the 50s, which is just a grand story, and it's the shape of it is pretty much, in the 50s, I did this, did this, did this, in the 50s, we this, and by the last line, that was the end of the 50s. And I would say to somebody in a class, I would say, okay, just pick any decade or pick a year of your life and just list some of the things that happened. But most recently, the really interesting results came from asking them what they gave away, got rid of, stopped doing in the last chunk of time, year or so, what they gave away, whether it's or got rid of friends, friendships, people, attitudes, stuff,
mm-hmm.
anything. And it's just uncanny to me, but so many people just in the process of making a list of things started writing a story. It became a story, what they divested themselves of and how and why. It just almost, without even trying, which is kind of magical.
Hmm. Interesting. I find it interesting, too, that you said, and I know that writers, it doesn't matter how long you write, it can still be a difficult thing, and
mm-hmm.
I think Norman Mailer said he had a hard time writing because every time he sat down, he had to be Norman Mailer. And that makes sense. But mm-hmm. I think beginning writers, hearing you say that writing is, I think you said, is daunting to me still.
Oh, sure. Well, a poet friend of mine, John Rubicki, put it wonderfully. He described writing as lunging at vacancy. I think that's very accurate and said by a poet. And truly, it is that. And but I'm quick to add, nobody's making me do it. You know, I don't complain. It's an observation. It's just, you know, it's hard, but so what? A million things are infinitely harder.
Yeah.
And no one's making me do this.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Amy Hempel, and her recent book is The Collected Stories. Tell me about your characters. Well, not about your characters, but so many fringe characters and characters sort of living on the edge or dealing mm-hmm. with mental illness or mm. dealing with difficulty. Where do these people come from?
Well, in large part from California.
I know some of them.
But I did spend some very formative years, my late teens, all my 20s, in San Francisco and in Los Angeles, Venice Beach and around there. And it was a weird time in my life. I was just sort of neither here nor there. I wasn't in school very seriously. I wasn't working. I was sort of drifting around. I just sort of got into a lot of situations and met a lot of kind of peripheral figures. You know what I mean? I was on the edges of a lot of things. And a lot of these people made an impression on me, a deep one, and they turned up, certainly in the first book, Reasons to Live, which most of the stories are set in California, and also later stories too. But for me, some wonderful single line or question almost wholly defines a person for me on the page. You know, I started a story with the line I overheard a clerk in a garden store ask when I walked in. This is in San Francisco years ago. I walked in and the guy said, "Are you here for all the things that I don't have?" and I'm like, wow, what a gorgeous sentence. And he meant that they'd already sold out on some advertised special I knew nothing about. So for me, it was this incredibly emblematic question that spoke to my relationship with my mother.
Yeah,
it's nothing to do with gardening.
Uh-huh. Interesting. So, and yet your stories, I mean, I don't necessarily see you. I mean, they don't feel like autobiographical stories.
Oh, good.
And yet, as you
said, and they're not always, but you know,
right.
They largely are.
But that's interesting because you've been able to take something that you've been through or someone that you know and mm-hmm. create a fiction,
mm-hmm.
which I think is hard to do.
Harder than something sort of fully imagined.
Yeah,
fully
because what do you keep and what do you leave out?
Exactly.
Without making the reader aware of the writer and that the writer went through this.
I mean, but I think that you can't help but modify and change a story. Even if something really happened to you, you tell somebody and you're already embellishing and changing it to make it a better story without even meaning to a lot of the time. I think it just sort of comes naturally, and that certainly helps the writer.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever worry about people recognizing themselves?
I've worried about it a couple of times, and in one of the cases, it was a story in the first book about a comedian, about a stand-up, an improv improvisational comic, and it was based in large part on a good friend of mine who had been a longtime member of the committee. I don't know if people will remember that group of the committee. And he's a very good friend named Morgan Upton, and so I showed it to him to see if it was okay with him, and I was very uneasy. It's not a bad portrayal at all, but it just, I didn't know how he'd feel, and he said, oh, no one had ever accorded him such respect and had really paid attention to him in this way, and so he took it as it really was intended, which was he's a fascinating person to me, and I wanted to remark him.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, will you read to us again?
Sure. Okay. I have another short. It's just over 2 pages. It's part 4 of the 4-part title story of my last collection, The Dog of the Marriage. These are 4 related but separate stories. This is number 4. For $60 charged to my MasterCard in advance, the psychic described a wooded area near a body of water. A pond, a stream, she couldn't be sure, with the view across an open field to a civic-type building. A post office, a school, she couldn't be sure, where according to her vision as relayed to me over the phone, the lost dog had looked for food in the last 24 hours. This was less useful than the woman down the turnpike who saw the leaflet I left on her windshield. She phoned to say she had seen the dog drag a deer across the tracks 100 yards away the day before. I found the dead deer beside the tracks where the woman said, part of its flank gnawed to the bone. The dog could not have felled the deer. It must have been hit by a train. The leaflet is all over town. The ex-husband made it. He advertised a reward beside a picture of the dog, but he did not consult with me first. The reward would not buy you an ordinary dinner in this town. Whenever I come across any of his posters, I add a one before the amount. Despite the reward, calls come in. I chase down all sightings, even when the caller says the collar is red, not blue. But there's never any dog of any kind with any color of collar in the spot reported by the time I am able to get there. I check construction sites. Workmen eat lunch outdoors, and a hungry dog might try them for a handout, wouldn't she? Half a dozen calls come from builders on the beachfront. Once when I got there, there was a deer swimming in the ocean. It appeared to be caught in the tide, and as I moved toward it, toward the deer, it managed to pull itself ahead of the surf, where it found its footing and limped ashore on a hurt front leg to leap away when I moved closer. So I, who only wanted to help, was made to stand there watching the deer head for the dunes. I went out again at night to lay down scent trails in the woods near my house, wearing the same shoes and socks I had been wearing for days. The moon was nearly full above a snowy field. When I had made my way into the woods, I turned and saw deer standing side by side watching. I thought, saints, guardian angels, my saviors, my friends. We watched each other for a while, and then I went home, checking over my shoulder all the way for the deer. They never moved once, not that I saw. Mm. There were three animal psychics. I found them all. The famous one, you can't get to work with you anymore unless you're the president of something and your dog is, too. Still, this woman phoned me from the airport between flights. She gave me the names and numbers of the other psychics who found missing dogs. I called the most psychic-sounding one first, who turned out not to be available until after the holidays. What holidays? Were there holidays? I left a message for the next one, and the third psychic answered her phone and insisted we could go to work with no delay, so long as I could describe my dog to her and recite the numerals of my credit card number. Every morning and every night, there is a videotape I watch. The ex-husband made it when he was my husband. It was made when the dog had first come to us and seemed to be everywhere, shared everything, offering. I see the viewfinder swing wide across the lawn, one of those panning shots you always find in movies, where the idea is to get everybody in the audience ready for what will presently be revealed, but only if everybody will just be very, very good and very, very patient and will wait with perfect hope for the make-believe story to unfold.
Hmm. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Amy Hempel reading from the collected stories and from The Dog of Marriage. When I read your work or hear you read, but especially when I read your work, since that's what most of my time is with this book, I get the sense that you pay such close attention to what's going on, to sound, to light, to what things mean. Is that so, or are you able to turn that off?
No, that's pretty much always going. And there are two writers I admire no end, and who always were and still are an inspiration to me along these lines, both in Los Angeles. One is Bernard Cooper, one is Mark Richard. Bernard Cooper, though he's written several books since, I think about his first book, which is called called Maps to Anywhere, and there were these wonderful pieces throughout that were, you could say they were prose poems or short shorts, they kind of defy absolute definition, but oh my God, the sounds, they were just, they're exquisite little pieces, and I've taught them, I read them over and over, and Mark Richard is another of the writers who is just extraordinarily conscious of language. I think he taught briefly at Irvine and some years ago, and he's now writing films and adapting one of his stories for the screen, and he went so far as to study sounds in terms of autistic children, and learning that he learned that certain sounds affect autistic children in certain ways. It doesn't matter what you're saying; it's just the sound, and he would consciously use these sounds in his writing to get an effect across, or to get a reaction from a reader on a kind of purely emotional levels that the reader might not even be aware of, you know, why he or she was responding that way, but it had to do with the sounds inside the words he chose, and it was just, that's a really kind of remarkable attention.
So, do you have an incredible memory, or do you make notes, or how does it all come out?
I have a good memory for trivia, for things that really don't matter. I never remember anything useful. I don't know any history. I don't know any math. I don't know. I mean, I'm going a little bit overboard. I can remember some things, but really, I just. But maybe that means that these are the things that I find important. Ultimately, what somebody said, or the way Barry Hanna will write mother-in-law for a certain Southerner, to say instead of mother-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is important to me. So things like that lodge in my head, or just the way people say something unexpectedly, or turn the received information on its head. That's what I'll remember.
Mm-hmm. We have a few minutes left with Amy Hempel, author of many brilliant short stories, and her most recent book is The Collected Stories, published by Scribner, a beautiful book. I always comment on the cover, and I love this cover with the repetition of the photograph and the dog. You with
that
the dog.
Dog is, that was my dog, Audie, and she is the dog in the story I just read.
Mm.
The dog had disappeared.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
But having said that, I can just also add a lot was invented in the very brief story I read, but it did take as its point of departure the disappearance of a beloved dog.
Yeah, yeah. The state of the short story. Now, short story writers, writers that love the form, that need to write mm-hmm. in the form, mm-hmm. of course need to write in the form and do,
right.
But there still always seems to be the worry of publishing. Where can I place this? What can I do with it? Is the short story a dinosaur? What do you think about all that? What do you say to students that, or even other writers that are concerned
about being able to publish short fiction?
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
you know, because you hear, oh, it's easier to publish a novel than a short story.
I don't think that that's true. I know that that is what you tend to hear, and I just don't see that that's the case, because short story collections are always coming out. And and yes, some of the big venues have dried up, the Atlantic Monthly fairly recently, and the places that publish short stories. But that's just the big slick magazines, some of them. I mean, there are just tons of little magazines out there with very careful readers and very excited readers and just dying to read short stories. So that's pretty much what I say to students, is just do multiple submissions and send them all out to these wonderful literary magazines. But And you know, you look around and they're both wonderful debut collections, and then there are people coming out with second books from smaller presses that are just electrifying. I think of Gary Lutz, it's LUTZ, and his stories aren't like anybody else's. His sentences are not like anybody else's, and that's thrilling to come across. And he's being published regularly, and then in a more commercial press, you have very recently a new collection by George Saunders, who is absolutely hilarious and a real stylist. And there's just enormous range in what a story can be. So I'm always excited as a reader, a writer, a teacher, to see stories that amplify possibilities for what a story can be.
Mm. A lot of what you've been talking about, especially when you talk about other writers and how they, you know, as you said about Gary Lutz, that he sounds unlike anyone else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking voice and how writers find that voice. How do you direct students to voice, to really sounding like themselves and not being derivative?
A couple things. I point out that the job is not to find their voice, which just is enormous. I mean, how would you even begin? But to find a voice for this story. And just I have people read. I have students read original voices. You know, Walter Kern doesn't sound like anybody. Barry Hanna, Padgett Powell, Christine Scott. I mean, I could go on forever. But reading them, putting those voices in front of them, I have people eavesdrop all the time because you really, it's a quick way to see the difference between dialogue and the way people really sound. You know,
mm-hmm.
and one of the great writers, for everything, but also for dialogue, is Mary Robeson. His last novel won the LA Times Book Prize a couple of years back, a book called Why Did I Ever? And that's maybe the first contemporary book I put in front of students who want to know about voice and how people really sound. And although it's a novel, it's written in entirely in vignettes, and she has a real appreciation for the moment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it works. It works as story. It works as novel. It's hugely helpful to just about everybody who, no matter what they're working on.
Mm. Well, I like that. I like what you said. Don't try to necessarily find your voice, but
no.
Find a voice.
A voice for this story.
Yeah.
Then the next story you're writing, you see what works there. And and also, you know, people forget that they forget to sometimes to look at what works for them off the page. and so I'll say, well, try to be mindful of how you get by in life, and can you bring that to the page? For example, I know some people who are just terrifically funny, but they get serious on the page because
mm-hmm.
this is fiction. You know what I mean? But if they just relaxed and realized, you know, how successful they are when they're not trying, if they brought that to the page, that would be a compelling voice. So, you know, sometimes you just have to, again, it's like sort of tricking people into not trying so hard.
Yeah. Well, that seems to be, you know, one of the things, main tricks we do to ourselves is get ourselves to sit in the chair and stay there.
Mm,
and
true.
However you can trick yourself to do that to start with.
Yeah, exactly.
You have been just so wonderful to have on and
oh, thank
so
you.
Much great, great information for the writers who are listening. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me on.
You're quite welcome. Maybe when your paperback comes out, you can come back.
I'd love to.
Thank you. That was Amy Hempel. Her most recent book is The Collected Stories, published by Scribner, a nice hefty book of stories from previous collections. Just a brilliant short story writer. And anyway, this show will be podcast, so you can send your friends who missed it to listen next week, hopefully, at penonfire.com. Click on the radio tower. And you will be brought to the radio page, and you will be able to listen to this and to so many other shows. We're at the end of our time together for this evening. I'll be back again next week with Susan Siegel and Diana Abu-Jabbar. I'm going to leave you with a quote by Ray Bradbury, who said, "Quantity produces quality. If you only write a few things, you are doomed." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next time.